The book the father and the boy would soon read together in the boy's hospital room had once been the mother's, her favorite, and the father had been waiting for the boy to be old enough to read it himself so that he might love what his mother had once loved. The book was thick, black-skinned, filled with many pages of tight-spaced text, all too hard for the boy to decipher on his own, and so the father decided he couldn't wait any longer. He would read the book to the boy as much as he could in the time they had left.
That was an excerpt from the short story Long Walk with Only Chalk to Mark the Way from Matt Bell's forthcoming collection, A Tree or a Person or a Wall. My name is Robert Eisenberg, and I talked with Matt for KBOX Heart of the Arts. You have a lot of inventive titles. For example, one of your previous novels is called In the House Upon the Dirt Between the Lake and the Woods. There's a sort of freedom that comes with a title like A Tree or a Person or a Wall, isn't there?
I like the rhythm of it first, which is probably part of it for me always, the rhythm of the language. The story is about a young boy who's been abducted, and he's being kept in this room with a giant ape that's guarding him. And when the man who's abducted him comes in and out of the room, the boy can see through the window, he can see something that's either a tree or a person or a wall. And so it's this thing in the distance upon which he sort of fixates his imagination that he imagines might save him when he is rescued, that he'll be able to know for sure what this other life outside the room is.
One of the themes that I find really striking in a lot of your fiction is family.
I come from a big family, and family's really important to me. My marriage is really important to me. I'm not a parent, but I write about childhood and about parents a lot. And one of the things I think I write about a lot is about the fear of loss, trying to stop loss, trying to make loss impossible, which of course you can't do. One of the reasons to write about family over and over, write about marriage and about parenthood, those are the things you're most afraid to lose that would matter most if you lost. To lose your partner, to lose your children, those are the big losses. The higher the stakes, the better the story, and those are the highest stakes.
Our guest today has been Matt Bell, here on Heart of the Arts on KBOX. Thank you so much, Matt, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
To start out with, I've had the good fortune to run into a lot of people who've read your books before, and I always enjoy asking them essentially what you do. They always say that it's like macabre, or it's horror, or it's science fiction, or it's magical realism. For someone, say you're on a plane to Singapore and someone learns that you're a writer,
right. How
do you explain your work?
Man, I feel like I try not to tell people on planes because they're always reading books they'd much rather be reading. but I think it's always weird to explain what you do because the aboutness of books, you know, it's like the book is about this is what's in it, never really tells you anything, right? It's like, it's a weird thing. But, you know, obviously I would consider it like literary fiction. I think it's often called sort of experimental fiction, which is fine. I think of a lot of what I do, or I used to when I thought more about genre terms, is non-realist fiction. So I'm interested, and I grew up on things like science fiction and fantasy and mythology and fairy tales, maybe especially fairy tales is like a big link for me. Historical fiction. And I think I'm still using a lot of those genres, you know, hopefully in a literary and artistic way. So I think that's sort of the jumping off point. Is there was a time when I was learning to write, so maybe my early 20s. I mean, I'm always learning to write, but when I was learning to write, where I really got into people like Dennis Johnson and Raymond Carver and Hemingway and Amy Hempel and Christine Scott and people who are like very realistic, did different things stylistically, but were realists. And I think there was a long time where I kind of put away that other stuff I liked and like, this is what serious fiction was. And when I was in my maybe mid to late 20s, I started folding back in some of those other influences and started letting back in my interest in fabulism, in myth, in fairy tales, in science fiction, in detective fiction. There's a lot of bad detectives in my fiction. and started folding that stuff back in, and as I did that, the fiction kind of came to life. Like, that's more true to who I really am and why I'm a reader. And so I think it, you know, it's all those things, which, as you said, is way too complicated for telling someone on a plane anywhere. Although, to Singapore, you would at least have enough time to bore them to death with it. So that would be good.
Was there, like, an aha moment when you were younger where you decided, I want to be a writer. This is it.
I think I was writing early, but not in a, like, I'm going to be a writer way. I think my parents have all the stuff I wrote when I was very, very young, but my sort of memories of, like, trying to write stories or trying to write, like, a book are really, like, middle school. The summer between 7th and 8th grade, I wrote this, like, 200-page fantasy novel in, like, the text editor in DOS. That was just, like, a combination of all my favorite scenes from fantasy novels I'd read, right? Like, it was like a long cover song. And I think that was really the first impulses, but they were real readerly. I just wanted there to be, like, more of the things I liked. I was just imitating, but in a really happy way. I mean, now people maybe do that in a more pure fan fiction way. They think of it with those terms. I didn't know those words. But then I didn't write for a long time, and that didn't really go anywhere, and I didn't think of it as something, like, to do. It was just, like, an extension of liking to read. And then in my early 20s, I dropped out of college, and I was reading a lot. I was always reading a lot.
What had you been studying up until that point?
Computer science, and I think it was political science for a while. But I didn't stay very long. I only went to college for 3 semesters the first time. But then I started reading contemporary fiction. I'd never really read any, like, contemporary literary fiction. It'd all been the classics, you know, or maybe up through the 60s or 70s. And I started reading Vonnegut and Carver and Amy Hempel and Dennis Johnson, some of those other people I mentioned. And it just kind of took my head off, and I wanted to read more of it. And I didn't know where to go. I didn't know where to look. I didn't know who they were or how they got there. You know, I remember, I didn't know anyone else in the rural Michigan area from that read Dennis Johnson. I, like, couldn't find people to talk about the books with. And so I think it's that same kind of response I had in the 7th grade, where I needed there to be more of these kind of stories, and I didn't have them. So I started trying to make them poorly and bad cover versions of them. But that was sort of the beginning. And then I stayed writing, I think. And I got really into it and decided that's what I wanted to go back to school for when I did. You hear writers who talk about, like, not being readers or about not reading when they're writing a book. It just doesn't make sense to me. I'd much rather be a reader than a writer, if I had to pick one. And I think the act of reading great books is always a part of wanting to write or trying to write for me.
It's interesting you say that, because we're friends on Facebook. I follow your posts, and a lot of what you post is not necessarily what you're doing, but what you're reading. Mm. And a lot of times you end up tagging the authors of the books that you're reading because you know them.
Sure.
It's such a luxury to be part of that literary community, mm-hmm. and you have toured all across the country. What have you found from this vast web of people who all seem to kind of know each other?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I mentioned sort of not having people to talk about books with, and it was the same when I started writing. And I started writing, I was living in a town called Hemlock in Michigan, maybe like 2 hours north of Detroit. Very, very small. I graduated with 98 people in my high school class. You know, it's a pretty small town. And so I didn't know other writers. And so my first writing communities were online. Francis Ford Coppola the website's still there, I think, but it used to, or had created this website called Zoetrope.
Zoetrope, yeah, right.
Yeah. Which was this, like, online writing works thing that's free, and you could post stuff, and people would write little, like, critiques of it, and you critiqued other people's. And so the first writers I knew I met there, it's really interesting in some ways, because I feel like not only did I meet some of my first writer friends there, but so many of the people on that site were just starting out, and they hadn't really started publishing yet, and they were a long way from books, even if they had a couple magazine publications. And so many of the people that were on that site around that same time, which is maybe, like, let's say, like, late 90s, early 2000s, are now people who have novels out with big presses and have all these awards and are people I've known forever. So that community is really vital. Like, it mattered to me a lot. And I think I do feel sort of a responsibility to try to build community where I go and to try to include as many people as possible, partly because I needed that so desperately. And of course still do, right? You don't stop needing that. So that's sort of the beginning of it. But I think a lot about what people call now literary citizenship, and this idea of of building community, of being a good literary citizen. And for me, the simplest way to do that is to tell other people about the books you're enjoying, to encourage other writers to, actually, I got an email this morning from someone who'd read one of my books, and it kind of came in when I was like having a bad day at the desk, right? And it's like, well, I don't know if this book's going to turn out, but it's nice that someone enjoyed that one, you know? And it's so encouraging as a writer. It's being a writer is not like being in a band where you can go and play a show and 1,000 people react to the thing you made right there, you know?
It's a very silent art.
Yeah. Your book comes out, and even if tons of people buy it, they don't read it like in 5 minutes and send you an email, right? The day your book comes out, it's very silent. And so I think we all need to hear that. And so, so some of that online stuff is just spreading the word about things I think are interesting. And it always comes right back to you. Like, you recommend a book, and immediately someone's like, have you read this book, or have you seen this thing? Or I'll post an interview with somebody, and they'll be like, oh, it reminds me of this other thing I learned from this person. And so, on one hand, I'm putting all this stuff out for other people, but it constantly sort of immediately boomerangs back to me. And it's a way to have conversations I wouldn't have by myself. So much of what we do is solitary. So I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, you're from Michigan originally. Yeah. And your latest book is called Scrapper, which takes place in I want to say a post-apocalyptic Detroit, but it's really not that far from what Detroit is like right now. The book came out as you were living in Phoenix, mm-hmm. where you've been for about 2 years
now,
right?
Yeah.
What was it like to sort of revisit the home turf while living in a very different part of the country?
I think I wrote most of the book in Michigan before I moved. I'm trying to remember exactly when I started it, but I think it came out last September, which was about a year after I moved. So I think I did like the final draft here, but I think it had mostly been done, or maybe I just did the edits with my publisher. But it was still interesting to sort of work on it from afar. A lot of the protagonist's experience is that he's moved away from Michigan for 10 years and come back. And it was weird doing the final draft of that book, having just moved away from Michigan for the first time, and recognizing some of the emotions that I imagined a person might, you always have that, right? Where you visit somewhere that you've researched but never gone to, or an experience you've written about but haven't had yet.
It's like when you write about old people.
Yeah,
you have older characters, and you haven't been one yet.
Like. Yeah, I mean, there's so much stuff like that, right? Writing about marriage before you're married. Mm-hmm. You know, you just had a first kid, right? And you have that experience you've written about children or parents or other things. Then later you're like, well, I got that right. I got that wrong. You know, so some of it was that. It was interesting to think about the things I was missing from afar. It's always interesting books come out because they get looked at through the lens of where you are when they come out. You know, people, there's like this assumption that you wrote the book like yesterday, which is always really odd.
Whereas it could have been, I mean, you could have finished the final draft a year ago or longer, right?
Yeah. My first novel takes place in this sort of pastoral, mythic wilderness, novel called In the House Upon the Dirt Between the Lake and the Woods. And it's very like outdoorsy and in the forest, and there's like a giant bear, and there's all this like kind of Michigan outdoors seeming stuff, although it's very not Michigan necessarily. And it came out when I was living in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is much more remote and much more forested and much more rustic. But I wrote it in a condo in like downtown Ann Arbor, right? You know. But when I moved and the book was coming out, like every interview I did, people were like, "How does your living in like the Upper Peninsula of Michigan influence this book?" And I was like, "Not at all. Like,
it's been a while.
It influences your reading of the book, but it has absolutely nothing to do with it." And I think that framing is always a little interesting. I'm sure having moved away will change how I read those books going back. I have a new story collection coming out in the fall, and I wrote all those stories over a 10-year period of living in Michigan, and it's interesting to go back to them and to think about how Midwestern they are, even though most of them aren't explicitly set in the Midwest. And it's very obvious to me that they are, even when they don't say that. That they could only be.
I'm a sucker for good titles. I'm glad you brought that up. And I particularly enjoy about about at least a couple of your books is these very elaborate imaginative titles.
Oh, thank you.
And again, the one was In the House Upon the Dirt Between the Lake and the Woods.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, finally got it right. And then the short story collection coming out is A Person or a Tree or a Wall. A Tree or a Person or a Wall is the book coming out shortly. There's a sort of freedom that comes to having a title that open and mysterious. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with them and essentially allow yourself to put them on a cover?
Yeah, I mean, they're always interesting. I think I had the title for In the House for a long time. I think it was, in some ways, I think it's generative of the book. The book had a very sort of mysterious genesis where I didn't know what I was doing with it for a long time. I had all these little elements, and some of them were this place, this house upon this place called The Dirt. They'd come to build this house, and there's a woods and a lake, obviously, that it's sort of between. It's a very strange, like, pocket universe, and it's almost a constraint. Like, the book doesn't go outside of that bubble ever. And so the title was generative in a certain way. I'm going to forget who says it right now. Kevin Brockmeyer has this quote that I really like where he talks about having a title while you're writing a book, and that the title is the target toward which you fire the arrow of the book.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. How good is that, right? I really love that. And I think for that book, that was very true. It was like, It was always the title because it had, somehow that was what the book was. It mm-hmm. was, you know, that was in it. You know, the new book is a story collection, which are always harder to name, I think, what encompasses it, what sort of is, without over-defining it, and how does, you know, et cetera, et cetera. A Tree or Person or a Wall is the name of one of the stories in the book. It's the first story in the book. It's one that hasn't been collected before, but it's... I like that it's a little mysterious. I like that it's a little, I like the rhythm of it first, which is probably part of it for me always, the rhythm of the language. But I also, well, let me tell you what it does in the story, and that will highlight it. The story is about a young boy who's been abducted and is in a, it's a very strange story. He's being kept in this room with a giant ape that's guarding him. And when the man who's abducted him comes in and out of the room, the boy can see through the door a window in the hallway. And through the window, he can see something that's either a tree or a person or a wall. And so it's this thing in the distance upon which he sort of fixates his imagination that he imagines might save him, that he might, when he rescues himself, that he'll be able, or he is rescued, that he'll be able to know for sure what this other life outside the room is. And so I like that sort of dangerous mystery of it, you know, and this distant thing you can't quite see, but it's like vitally important that you figure out what is, you know, the question of what that thing is drives the boy in certain ways.
And presumably, as surreal as the title is, someone will hit that point where they're like, aha,
yeah, right.
I get it now, right, sure. Right, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. One of the themes that I find really striking in a lot of your fiction is family.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I think about it is I remember a review of one of Richard Ford's books, mm-hmm. where it was in the New York Times, and they described his characters as rootless yuppies.
Right.
And yours are very much the opposite of that, where even if they don't seem to come from anywhere, mm-hmm. they're building these families. Or I mean, essentially, most of In the House is about trying to build a family, mm-hmm. and to conceive and to raise children and all of the calamity that follows. And Scrapper also, it's about finding a child in this post-apocalyptic Detroit, yeah. and kind of figuring out how to be a sort of parental mm-hmm. figure to this mm-hmm. abandoned kid. Yeah. Where do you think that theme comes from? Is that a specific thing, or is it just a general preoccupation with families?
Yeah, I think in some ways it might be more general. I mean, I come from a big family, and family's really important to me. My marriage is really important to me. I'm not a parent, but I write about childhood and about parents a lot. I don't know. I don't want to be too prescriptive about it. I'm very suspicious in fiction and in life of the, like, this happened, and so this is how it turned out. But I think broadly, I write about a couple things or characters doing a couple things. And one of the things I think I write about a lot is about the fear of loss and the trying to sort of trying to stop loss, trying to make loss impossible. Which of course you can't do. And so I think one of the reasons to write about family over and over, write about marriage and about parenthood, those are the things you're most afraid to lose that would matter most if you lost. To lose your partner, to lose your children, those are the big losses. And so in some places it's, you know, just in a, I don't think of it this way, but just in a purely practical fiction way, the higher the stakes, the better the story, and those are the highest stakes.
When people describe your work as horror,
yeah,
the most nightmarish situation is someone very close to you being something happening to them.
Absolutely. And so I think that's part of it. I think the other thing I've read about a lot, the action of a lot of, especially short stories, which do not always have the same kind of plots, I think a lot of my stories are about one of two things, and maybe they're the same thing, really. Often a character takes on a new role, like at the beginning of the story. I mentioned having a lot of detective stories. A character will become, for some reason, be presented with like a mystery they have to solve and become a sort of detective. And now there's this role for them to do, to become a father, to become a husband, to become a wife. You know, it's to take on a kind of role, and now you're supposed to be this other person. Sometimes we really want it, you know, but we still don't necessarily know how to do it well. And I think the other thing is my characters are looking in different ways, even if they would never explicitly say this, for structures or systems or roles by which to like contain and control emotion or experience. There's a story in the collection that's it's called An Index of How Our Family Was Killed, making this book sound so uplifting, but it's just about, it's in the form of an index, so everything's alphabetized. And it's the narrator is a person whose parents and one of his siblings have been killed either purposely or accidentally in certain ways, and he's trying to like organize the facts of their life in a way that he could be sure him and his living sister are safe, you know, that this seemingly fated thing that's happened to their family won't happen to them, which of course you can't really know or be sure of, you know, but in less dramatic ways, I think. The family is one of those structures, the structure by which we organize our lives. And I think the way our family is built determines a lot of that, you know. And so I think some of those, you're not going to solve those things. You're not going to wear them out. They're not going to be exhausted. You're not going to be like, well, I've said everything I have to say about marriage. I'm probably just good.
And we're done.
Right. And we're done, right. I don't have to write about that anymore.
Why don't we have you read a selection, if that's all right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to read just a little bit from the last story in the book, which I think will go well with what we're talking about. This was almost the title story of the book, which is another really, really long title. And we changed it at some point, I think really based on the ordering of the book. But the story is called Long Walk with Only Chalk to Mark the Way. And it's about a father and son. The son is diagnosed at the beginning of the book with a incurable disease, and he's not going to leave this hospital. He's going to live out the rest of his life in this hospital. He's aging really quickly. I'm not sure it's a real disease. I think it's mostly works the way it works for the story. And the mother has passed away like years before, and the father starts reading this book to the son while they're in the hospital. That's the story of the Minotaur and the Labyrinth, and eventually they start acting it out. They start treating the hospital like it's a maze, and they go out with backpacks every day, and they mark this path through the maze of the thing. So I'm just going to read from near the beginning about the book they're reading, and then their prep for the long walk. The book the father and the boy would soon read together in the boy's hospital room had once been the mother's, her favorite, and the father had been waiting for the boy to be old enough to read it himself so that he might love what his mother had once loved. The book was thick, black-skinned, filled with many pages of tight-spaced text, all too hard for the boy to decipher on his own, and so the father decided he couldn't wait any longer. He would read the book to the boy as much as he could in the time they had left. The book was many things, although even the father did not know this at first. The book was a story and a guide and a map, one that pointed the way through a maze with sentences and paragraphs instead of symbols and lines, so that even before the father told the boy there was a maze to be solved, the book was already teaching him how he might do such a thing, if only he paid attention, if only he were careful. The story in the book was simple. It was about another boy, a young boy, 13 or 14, older than the father's boy, but a boy nonetheless, who went into a maze to save his own life, aided by a girl who loved him. The father's own boy did not have a girl who loved him, not yet, but he had a father, and it would have to be enough. The boy asked, what was he looking for in the maze? The father said, nothing. He only wanted to find his way back out so he could be with the girl. But then why did he have to go into the maze in the first place? Okay, the father said. There was something else. He said there was something in the maze that wanted to hurt the boy, but the boy planned to hurt it first. A monster? Yes, said the father. Yes, in the maze, there was a monster. The boy loved the book, listened rapt while the father read. The boy told the father he wished he could go on his own adventure, that anything would be better than lying in his hospital bed. And so the father, who no longer denied the boy anything, promised he would. For the last time, the father left the boy alone. He went to their home, where he boarded the windows as if for a storm. He walked once more from room to room, cataloging their contents. Then he stepped out the front door and locked the house tight. Afterward, he shopped, gathered supplies. At one store, he bought himself a good backpack, bought a smaller but otherwise identical one for the boy. At another, he bought 12 pounds of dehydrated food. He didn't know how much he needed of anything. He selected 2 sleeping bags, then a tent a salesman guaranteed him could be put up in the dark by a single person. He bought flashlights to light their way, and also thick sticks of glow-in-the-dark chalk to mark their passage. He chose new boots for the long walk ahead, size 11s for himself and size 2s for the boy. When he held up the boy's boots, the father felt as he always did when he bought the boy clothes. How could the boy be this small and still always be in so much danger?
Beautiful. Now, I've always been curious about this. You read so well. You are very comfortable reading in front of audiences, and you do read on these book tours across the country, sometimes revisiting bookstores and various venues all over the place. I listened to In the House on audio.
Oh, interesting.
But it was not you.
Sure, yeah.
Do they not let you read your books, or have you why have you not narrated your own books?
I don't know. Well, I mean, it's never come up. I've never been offered to do it. Suppose I might if I were, although the idea of reading my own book aloud over and over to get every phrase right on record actually sounds kind of horrible. But it is interesting because obviously the way I read is so, it does sort of, is rhythmic in a certain way and is sort of looking after the language a certain way. I'm not sure that's what the average person wants from an audiobook. You know, there's sort of a prize. I think the prize is clarity. When I'm reading in a bookstore or at a university or some other kind of reading series, I think the prize is not clarity. I think the prize is performance and experience.
Our guest today has been Matt Bell, here on Heart of the Arts on KBOC. Thank you so much, Matt, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.